C'est beau. Alors R22 tout le monde, antenne Art Sport 2024. Alors et après?
Professor Lisa Stansby, you are Dean of the Leeds School of Arts of Leeds Beckett University. You yes. wear many hats. Can you tell us a little more about your role at Leeds Beckett University and the other things you do?
Yes, I'm Dean of the Leeds School of Arts, which is a big provider of creative education in the north of England, in the city of Leeds. In our school, we've got over 3,000 students, around 40-odd courses, and we're part of Leeds Beckett University. The school itself dates all the way back to 1846, used to be called Leeds College of Art. So it's got over 170, 190 years history. And actually, interesting, we've got an archive of that, but that's a whole different thing. So we're well known for particularly art and design education, even actually forming the framework for art and design education in the 60s in the UK. Some of the pioneering things, particularly to do with performance art, actually. Shaped the way creative education was delivered in the UK. So it is a great school to be the dean of. Unusually, I studied here as well. So I did my BA, my MA and my PhD actually at this school, which is kind of, I guess, one of my many hats. So I've got the hat of somebody that graduated from the school that I'm now in charge of. I've worked at other universities in the UK, but I came back to do this job in 2015. And also probably one of the things that I really liked about coming to Leeds Beckett University as well is it's known for arts education, creative education, and it's known for sport as well. So that fits really well with my interests personally and also in terms of research.
Yeah. I didn't realize that there'd been that whole progression from student to to dean. Yeah. But did you establish yourself as an artist or an academic first, or has it always been kind of connected for you?
I've got a fairly unusual trajectory into universities because my background was in secondary school teaching in art. So I was a practicing artist as well as being a school teacher. And then I moved to teach in what we call in the UK further education, which is colleges. And I started was involved in setting up degree programs at colleges and then started to work in universities. So I've worked through every level of education in teaching sense. And throughout that time, I've been a practitioner, with a fine art background. That's what my first degree's in, mainly around sculpture and film. And my PhD, the submission for that, it's a practice-based PhD, is about, I think it's 12 pieces of work, but I think about 8 of them are short artist films. Mm-hmm. And I guess as a result as well of the PhD, it made me rethink my practice because just after I finished that, I felt like there was two versions of myself in existence in the world. One which was, I guess, an academic and a practicing artist, and another as a sports person. And actually, those two worlds didn't know about the other world generally. And so I started at the time in around 2011, making work as an artist around art and sport. And at that particular point, I was involved heavily in swimming, and particularly channel swimming. So swimming from England to France and the whole channel swimming community around that, which is massive. And I got a sabbatical from my job at the time at the University of Huddersfield to make a body of work that was mainly based around the ideas of channel swimming. And it was really good because I was connected to that sport world as well as being an artist. So it wasn't necessarily I was on the outside observing. I was actually fully embodied in the sport world of channel swimming, as it was at the time, which resulted in me doing a channel relay. So there were 6 of us that swam the channel. So that's how I started bringing, I guess, the worlds of art and sport together. It initially started from my own personal interests. And at that time it was swimming. And since it's developed into triathlon, and at the moment it's more specifically in running. And so, yeah, it started from there, I think. Yeah.
Can you remember the moment when this, you sort of made the connection between?
I can actually, because it was stimulated by being offered the sabbatical. Mm. It felt like I'd done what I wanted to do with my PhD in terms of practice, which is really quite different. And I was known for that work. So I was known as an artist that made short films with quite complicated narratives. And it was all actually about literature coming from the Alippo group of writers. And I'd kind of done a great deal of practice on that, and it did feel like I was kind of ready to look for something new. And then I was offered a sabbatical from my job for 6 months, and the idea of it was to create a new body of work. And then that got me thinking about what is it as an artist that I'm interested in. And it was kind of some kind of reckoning with this sport side of me is a really big part of my life, and it seems a bit odd to ignore in some ways that side of what I do. And I was so interested, particularly in channel swimming at that time. So it was that point, really, being offered the space and the time to think about my actual practice, that was the point where I started to make artwork about sport. Yeah.
And so how did you do it? How did you swim across the channel? And I read that you created some swimming machines.
Yeah. So the work I did around channel swimming was around a lot of the language that's used in that particular pretty niche sport.
Yeah.
So there's, I mean, like most sports, there's kind of almost a cult aspect to things. So in the channel swimming community, there's a language that's used, certain sayings that are used. There's a really long history that everyone, if you are involved in it, is supposed to be aware of. There's even a hierarchy in channel swimming. So in the UK, there's somebody that's the queen of the channel and the king of the channel, that swam the channel the most times. And somebody that what used to be known, because they ran throughout generations of their family, channel swimming training, the channel general in Dover. So it's got a whole interesting, like most sports, thing around that. So I started making practical work about those kind of things that I was involved with. And then I was training for the swim, the relay swim, which also involved getting used to cold water. So to swim the channel, you have to qualify by swimming for 2 hours in water that's below 16 degrees. So that was an ask for me in itself. It isn't generally for everyone, but it depends how much body fat you've got and how much you feel the cold. Yeah. So I went through this process of acclimatization, and I started making films about that, because you get something called the shakes after it, where your body shakes. And I found that really interesting, which actually led me to read up some of the science behind that as well.
Does it continue or do you get better at?
You get better. It's called afterdrop. And basically when you get out of the water, because all of your blood rushes to preserve your internal organs while you're in cold water, when you get out, then it's trying to kind of go back to where it was. And so the shaking actually is your body's muscles trying to warm your body up. So depending how cold you are, obviously the shaking's worse, but your body gets used to it. And actually in some cold water swimmers, their body's so used to it that actually their body almost adjusts itself before they get in the water.
You become fish.
Yeah. So my films were very, very funny, actually. I think they are funny. Some people find them a bit shocking. Handheld films with a phone usually. So I'm shaking trying to film it, as well as me being quite shaking quite a lot in the film. So that was more documentation of the process of training for that relay. So yeah.
And so the swimming machines sort of evolved after that?
Yeah, so I was still heavily involved in swimming, and I was interested in, I guess, the history of swimming in the UK. So around the time of the first Channel swim, and I'll get this wrong probably, it's something like 1870 something, there was a renewed interest because of that in swimming in the UK, but not many people actually at the time could swim. So lots of inventors came up with ideas to try and get people ready for swimming in water, or train people for swimming but on dry land, because there was such a high percentage of drownings, it seems quite risky going in water if you couldn't swim. So I used Google Patents, which is a storage archive online that anyone can access, to look at all the patents that were developed from around the 1860s onwards to do with swimming. Mm. And using some of those, I mean, a lot of them are really bizarre, fantastical, contraptions that people design thinking this looks a bit like swimming and might help people. So I took ideas from those patents and worked with another sculptor to develop a swimming machine that was totally impractical, that could be used on on dry land. And then it was shown in an exhibition where at the opening of the exhibition I'm actually swimming in it. Yeah, so that's where the swimming machine came from. And then I've done also a piece of work which is some collage, there's some actually in the background here, yeah. some collages based on those patents of swimming machines. So these are fictional ones I've made, but they look very similar to the actual patent drawings that people submitted. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite?
I like the ones where I've put people in the collage. Yeah, because it just looks quite strange. I mean, they all look like quite almost spaceship-like collages. And they were shown in an exhibition which was all about channel swimming that I had in Belfast in, I think it was, I've got to remember the year, I think it was 2014. Yeah, okay. Yeah, it was the year that happened. Yeah.
Were you involved with the London 2012 Cultural Olympiad events?
I wasn't involved in organising any of them. I went to many of them, and I was one of the things that started my interest in, I guess, a network fields of vision, was that I presented that channel swimming work at a conference which started off the Fields of Vision Network. So the conference was called Fields of Vision, and actually it was run by Leeds Beckett, where I am now. At the time I didn't work here, I worked at the University of Huddersfield, and I presented my findings and my practical work that came out of the sabbatical that I'd had at that conference. Also at that conference were lots of organisations that were part of the Cultural Olympiad. So one of them that I was involved with, because I was part of it, was Sea Swim. A really fantastic initiative that actually I think, and obviously I'm biased because it's swimming, but I think was one of the best projects that came out of the Cultural Olympiad in the UK. Mainly because it worked with the community that was already in that area of Scarborough. On the coast, and also it got lots of people from the community from all sorts of backgrounds actually swimming in the sea. So while they live next to the sea, they'd probably never been in it, some of the people, and it was all sorts of ages. And that carried on way after the Olympics as well, which I think is always, in my understanding of previous Olympiads, is one of, not the problems, but the challenges, I think, of the projects that are part of the Cultural Olympiad, is trying to find a way for legacy after the Olympics.
Yeah.
Sea Swim did a good job of that, because it's carried on. It's still going now in a slightly different format. They're more of a organisation that curates exhibitions and does community projects. It's not specifically related to swimming. Mm. Yeah.
Can you, I mean, do you think there was a Cultural Olympiad legacy? I mean, can you, are there other projects that you felt, I mean, what is it something?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some small examples of a legacy, C-Swim being one of them. And also some of the, it's kind of hard to pin down, I guess. Some of the things that you probably are a legacy are things like actually the Fields of Vision becoming, which actually wasn't actually a Cultural Olympiad project, but bringing all the different people from Cultural Olympiad projects together in that conference, then that developing into a network, and we stayed in touch with all of those different projects as well. And they are, I mean, Fields of Vision is quiet at the moment, it's kind of reforming itself. But they, for a long time, till at least the past year or so, those people stayed in touch and worked on separate projects together. So it's kind of, it has a legacy in different ways, not specifically the project that was developed for the Olympics, but through perhaps the connections and networks.
Yeah.
And also some of the arts and sports things coming together more definitely than they had done before, as carried on, not necessarily the same projects, but I think it's enabled other projects to happen as well. Yeah.
Can you tell us how it's reforming the Fields of Vision? Or
So it was an AHRC funded project, which is the Arts and Humanities Research funding body in the UK. And it was basically off the back of the conference, we applied for people that were interested, which were a professor, Jonathan Long from Leeds Beckett. It was myself from the University of Huddersfield, some academics from Manchester and Bristol. And we got together to put the bid in to develop a network that was more national to do with arts and sports. And we were awarded that grant. So we did a series of events around that, and we involved quite a lot of the organisations that were part of the Cultural Olympiad to present at those different seminars and conferences that we ran to talk about different things. Each event tended to have a focus on a different thing, such as the aesthetics. One was more about policy making. Beatrice Garcia presented at that one and has done some really interesting writing actually around Cultural Olympiads across lots of different Olympics. And then there was a different focus on one of the other ones to do with the manifesto itself and kind of developing that.
Can you tell us about the manifesto?
How that came together. So one of the things to do with that network is we proposed that we would do a manifesto. In the discussions with the main people involved in Fields of Vision, which was Professor Jonathan Long, myself, Doug Sandor, we talked about basically it being a manifesto. I like the idea of a manifesto in the early discussions because it made me think of arts manifestos and some kind of statement that might encourage people, like a call to action. So I like the term manifesto. Yeah. It took a lot of debate for that to be called a manifesto. But the idea was that we produced something that was really straightforward. So it's literally, I think, around two sides of A4 that arts and sports organisations could fully understand and potentially sign up to, I think, opening a dialogue more easy across arts and sports organisations. So one of the key things to do with the manifesto was the fact that in the UK, art and sport sits in the same government department, which is called DCMS, but they don't always, hardly ever speak to each other. And we wanted to kind of encourage that kind of dialogue, I guess, that had come out of stuff like the Cultural Olympiad to carry on. So our idea with it is to circulate that manifesto as a kind of call to action, and I think probably also ask arts and sports people to sign up to that, to sign up to consider projects in the future, to explore collaborative opportunities, and to kind of, where partnerships are established, to make sure that we could perhaps apply for further funding to encourage things in community-based. And also because I think it sets up a new space for things. So I think there was a real feel that this had huge opportunity for new audiences, new people to participate in things. In some senses, the arts can sometimes seem quite exclusive. In other senses, sports can seem all-inclusive if we think about the fans of football matches, etc. And it was to try and enmesh some of those different audiences together. So we did get a number of organisations sign up to it, probably not as many as we'd hoped to do. I think people, if I'm completely honest, were slightly more, perhaps the arts organisations were slightly nervous of signing up to something. The idea of signing your name to something as if it was perhaps some kind of a petition, which it wasn't intended to. I guess it was just intended to be some kind of agreement to future working together if the possibilities were there.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Do you know roughly how many organisations signed up?
I think we had about 20 so far, and we wanted to get people, I guess, of influence, or what you might call people of influence. So there was policymakers from local government that were asked to sign to it, etc., as well as our arts organisations. I mean, I think the idea of the manifesto was a really good one, and it set down principles that I think could be used. Perhaps it's the signing of it that was a bit that probably wasn't needed. You could use those principles and say, this is something to think about, and circulate it widely without saying you've got to sign on the dotted line. In hindsight, you learn these things.
Yeah. I know, but we're all art sport converts.
So. To us, it seems great, but yeah.
Do you feel it's a space for kind of reflection on society? Does it nourish your kind of art sport, which I guess is not really a term that exists necessarily in the dictionary, but is it a means of nourishing your research?
Yeah, I mean, personally, I'm really interested in that area of research, obviously because it's my two identities, but also because it's a hybrid area. Especially in the UK, I think it's fairly unusual to be researching in this area, and people are often surprised by it. So there's a lot of opportunity, it feels like, to work in this area as well, and also to disseminate research to different areas. So the area that I come from, fine art research, is heavily attached to certain Western philosophical ideas, largely French actually. And what I've found in doing research that's cross-disciplinary is it opens up much more opportunities to frame my research more widely, and also to make connections more widely. So most of the conferences and publications more recently that I'm involved in are not actually arts related. They're usually sport related. They've even been related to geography, psychology, all kinds of things. So they're multidisciplinary conferences and publications, which I think is much more interesting, and it's a wider expanse to be involved with, I think. So that's the great thing for me as well. And I think there's more opportunities in those areas as well, to be involved with different things, definitely. Yeah.
Can you tell us about what you're currently working on and kind of art sport projects and collaborations of the future?
There's a few small things I've been working on. So I mentioned my own, I guess, sport background. I moved in a way from, it's funny because my research interests have followed what my sport does. Maybe it's the other way around. So my research, as I mentioned, was involved in swimming. I then got involved with triathlon, swimming, running and biking. So I did some research around that, and that was also quite easy for me to do at Leeds Beckett, because we were heavily involved in the Triathlon Centre, the ITU World Triathlons held here. Alistair and Johnny Brownlee triathletes live 3 miles up the road from here. So the kind of world of triathlon is very Leeds based. Then also I've got involved more with running. I haven't got the time to train for triathlon. And then I've got involved in running networks. So more recently I've been involved with Kai, who started the Run Biennale, and I was advising them on another HRC bid that they've just put in, which is actually got European people involved in it. So the running network that they're involved in, I'm also involved in that. I've done some more, I guess, arts-based stuff to do with mapping of running. So and I've just recently given a paper about that, which is to do with Strava, which maps people's activities and the kind of rise in Strava and using Strava as a creative tool to draw with. So I've done a number of runs that are drawings that have been shown in exhibitions. And then I'm quite interested in more recently, I guess, the arts and sports policy side of things. And recent paper that I did, which was for the Athens Journal of Sport, talks a bit more, I guess, historically about how arts and sports were separate and how they might have come together. It talks a little bit about the Fields of Vision project and also about some areas of policy in the UK where arts and sports have tried to be brought together as well. My future project, I guess if I had more time, I'd probably be working on it now, would definitely be some kind of monograph, like a book that is written about arts and sports projects. And probably because it's it would be arts related. So one of the things probably to talk about is the fact a lot of the work I make, you would class it as visual art, even though some of it's performance art, I guess. Fields of Vision, their expanded version of arts and sports, included literature, poetry, dance, film, theatre, visual arts. So I think if I was to write a book around arts and sports, it probably would be more around the visual or performance-based arts that is more my own discipline. But no one's really done a kind of a monograph that surveys what's there. There's been a couple of exhibitions. I think there was one in quite a long time ago now, one in Berlin, and I can't remember the name of it. Power Play, I think it was called. It might have been way back in 2006, which was around arts and sports. And there's a lot of visual artists that make or have made work around that. But a book to try and collate that, I think, would be what I'd like to do next with my spare time.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. No, that's